Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, Preparing for Disaster in America, on Tuesday, July 15th, 2014. I'm your host, Joe Terry, and the South Bay Show is brought to you by the Academy of Foreign Languages. If you have any interest in learning a new language or brushing up on existing language skills, you should know about the Academy of Foreign Languages. Located in Palos Verdes, the Academy of Foreign Languages specializes in the art of communication. Their mission is to provide the finest language instruction possible. They recognize that each student has distinctive needs and craft their teaching technique to optimize an individual's particular learning skills. At the Academy of Foreign Languages, they strive to create a comfortable environment conducive to learning. So whether you're learning a new language or would simply like to converse in your native tongue, the Academy of Foreign Languages can accommodate you. For more information, visit their website at www.academyofforeignlanguages, that's all spelled out, academyofforeignlanguages.com, or call 310-975-4133. That's 310-975-4133. You can find out more about us at facebook.com/The South Bay Show or visit our website at thesouthbayshow.com. Preparing for disaster in America. This is a subject that can never be treated lightly, but we do our best to make it interesting, engaging, and yes, even entertaining to learn the few key skills and primary information that could save your life, your family's lives, that of a neighbor in a time of crisis, or the life of a treasured pet. Our mission is to engage hearts and minds and build knowledge and skills to help you prepare for whatever may come. This show is a true collaboration with solid roots in the community and a partnership with the official disaster preparation establishment. Our producer is founder and president of the local Manhattan Beach CERT Association and the Red Cross's community ambassador to Manhattan Beach, Mr. George Butts. Hey, George, how are you doing today?
Top of the morning, Joe. I'm very well, thank you. Listeners, good morning.
All right, yes. And, of course, with us today is owner, producer, writer of SouthBayByJackie.com, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well this morning, Joe. Hi, George.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm excellent.
Good.
So we've talked about many, many of the potential, I would say, what do we call it? It's an all-hazards approach, George, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Many hazards. But have we talked about this hazard before?
Just briefly, as we discussed terrorism,
right.
We discussed, you know, all of the CBR and these chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosive. So we've
right.
touched on all of these,
right.
but we've never really gone into and dwelled deeply into any of these particular subjects. So this is a first for us.
Well, it's great to have an expert guide us through this territory. Jackie, who's our guest today?
Our guest this morning is Harlan Dolgen of the Biodefense Network. Harlan has been a certified business continuity professional since 2003 with more than 15 years' experience in the area of business continuity, disaster recovery, emergency management, and pandemic preparedness. He is currently co-owner of the Biodefense Network, a firm specializing in pandemic and bioterrorism preparedness for public and private sector organizations. He previously worked at Thomson Reuters, U.S. Bank, and WellPoint. Harlan is an adjunct assistant professor of community health at St. Louis University, teaching business continuity management and pandemic planning. In 2006, Harlan founded the PandemicPrep.org, a not-for-profit organization working to prepare the St. Louis region for the next pandemic. PandemicPrep.org is the nation's leading grassroots pandemic planning organization and a trusted partner with FEMA HHS, Department of Homeland Security, and OSHA. Now, prior to his business continuity and disaster recovery career, Mr. Dolgin practiced civil and trial law for 8 years. He has maintained his law license with the state of Missouri since 1986. Welcome to the program, Harlan. We are so glad you could join us this morning.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, Harlan, this is one of those of the all hazards that we talk about. Of course, here in California, one of the big ones is the big one, earthquakes, and we talk a lot about that. But this one here, bio anything. I mean, most people think of when they think of a biohazard, or as opposed to a spill or of chemicals or something, they think of anthrax, they think of some other kind of bioterrorism weapon like that. Can you give us an overview of what the Biodefense Network is designed to prepare people for?
Sure. So it started out when we were with Pandemic Prep and we were a volunteer nonprofit organization. We were asked in 2011 to help St. Louis County prepare for a bioterrorism event by enlisting companies that would distribute medication that would primarily be for the example, as you pointed out, is anthrax. That's kind of what everybody's planning for, but there are others, bubonic plague, tularemia, Ebola, botulism, and viral hemorrhagic fever. Those are the main things that this program is designed to prevent against. And so what we did for St. Louis County was we helped them establish relationships and actually loose agreements, memorandums of understanding, with all of the larger employers in the county area. So the St. Louis County Health Department and all health departments across the country, so this applies everywhere, is responsible within 48 hours of a bioterrorism event to distribute medicine to all its citizens, you know, everyone that's in their county, regardless whether they're there visiting, whether they're undocumented, everybody that shows up to a location like a clinic to get medicine is supposed to get medicine. So within 48 hours, the health departments have to distribute to everybody in their jurisdiction, which is very daunting. They don't have the manpower to be able to do this. And so what St. Louis County did was they hired us to help establish relationships with companies like Enterprise, Express Scripts, the universities. There's four universities. Boeing is another one, the grocery chains. We got 15 of the 19 largest employers in St. Louis County to be part of this program, and basically that means that they'll distribute medicines to their employees, to the employees' families, because the families are included, and to any contractors, basically anybody, if it's a university, to students. We serviced public school districts also, some of the largest school districts in the area, and nursing homes. Nursing homes is a good example of somebody they can't go to get medicine from. You know, a clinic. They can't go to where the medicine is, so the medicine basically has to come to them.
Right.
And so in St. Louis County, we have over 725,000 people that would basically go to work to get their life-saving medications if there were a general anthrax release in the community,
mm-hmm.
which is something we don't expect. I mean, you know, there's no imminent danger that there's going to be an anthrax release anywhere in the United States. It hasn't happened en masse, but we do know it happened in 2001 after 9/11. You know, there were some letters that were sent to various places in Washington that contained anthrax. Five people died from that. So we know anthrax exists. We could go back to 1979 in Russia. And let me know, am I going okay?
Yes, absolutely. These are the kinds of things that people want to know about.
So back in 1979, in a village called Sverdlovsk, Russia, this was back when the Cold War was going on, there was a factory whose sole purpose was to make weaponized anthrax.
Mm.
And we know this because some of the anthrax got out into the community. There was a filter that was supposed to be replaced. It was removed. The next shift was supposed to come in and replace it. The man that was ending his shift left a note. They didn't see the note. So for a time, it got out through the ventilation system and into the general air, and anthrax spores got into a city, and almost 100 people died because of that. So So we know this exists. It's not like there's an imminent threat of it, but we have to be prepared as a country to deal with something like that, because you never know what the terrorists are going to do and what they're going to come up with next. So it's just something we have to be prepared for.
Right. And the reason, you know, I think that's very relevant, because what we've been hearing lately from the established, governmental bodies, the Homeland Security, saying is that, you know, things like anthrax, although it's well known how to weaponize anthrax, it's a process that the terrorist networks don't, generally speaking, have a lot of capabilities to go through, because they have to work out in the open, and of course they're working underground, and it's difficult for them to, for instance, create a factory. We knew that factory was there. Obviously, the U.S. government was watching it, and if they were working out in the open, we would see the defense or the terrorists doing that as well. So, what do you feel, Harlan, is one of the dangers, the hazards out there that we most likely will face in the near term?
Well, I think in the near term, in terms of bioterrorism, it probably is anthrax, but even maybe more threatening seems to be pandemic. We had the pandemic of 2009, and that's how I first started getting into pandemic and bioterrorism areas, learning about pandemic. So I really think everything I hear about pandemic is a little worrisome about the fact that there is, Ebola is certainly right. spreading and seems to be out of control in certain parts of the world, fortunately not here. And there's just other agents out there that are pretty worrisome. Anthrax, I mean, to me, because it's my livelihood, anthrax is something that is just an unknown quantity. We don't know if or when it's going to come. It's not like with anthrax, there's a guarantee that it will come. Mm-hmm. With a pandemic, because pandemics happen about three times every century, we know there's going to be another pandemic. There's going to be another virus that mutates into something that our bodies aren't accustomed to fighting,
right.
And it will, attack us. We got really lucky with the 2009 pandemic, by the way, because there was a very low mortality rate. Mm-hmm. The first year it happened, fewer people died. This is really a weird statistic, but fewer people died in 2009 from the H1N1 pandemic than died normally from influenza the rest of, other years. Because mm-hmm. about 35,000 people a year normally die from influenza, mostly, the very young and the very old.
Right.
But in 2009, I can't cite the statistics off the top of my head, but I believe it was even fewer than that.
Mm-hmm. What you describe, the public-private partnership in St. Louis County, it sounds very advanced. And how many counties around the country have that same kind of plan, where all the major employers already know that they're going to be distributing prophylactics in this case, or other medication to their employees and their employees' families and so forth? How many counties around the country are prepared, or as prepared as St. Louis County?
So the way you phrase that question, the answer is none, because we believe St. Louis County is the most prepared county in the country to deal with a bioterrorism attack. They have 1 million residents. So the fact that they have about 725,000 people that are part of these points of dispensing or pods really is the model for the rest of the country. And after that, we have been bringing it to other locations. So let me step back a little bit. The CDC, I'll describe this whole program for you, if you don't mind. It'll
sure.
take a couple minutes.
Sure.
So the CDC requires all health departments throughout the entire country to be prepared for a bioterrorism event and to be able to distribute medicine within 48 hours to all of its residents. So that's the starting point. The way public health has responded is, number one, at the local level, they have created something called open points of dispensing, or open pods, that are basically the clinics that I mentioned earlier, where they would set up clinics called open pods, and they would set them up throughout the counties, and sometimes it's city health departments, so city or county health departments. And they would distribute the medicine. The medicine is all free. There's no charge for any of this to any company or to any individual, because it's all purchased federally by the U.S. government. So first of all, you have open pots, but the health departments know that they don't really have the manpower to establish enough open pods and populate them enough. So, for example, we work in Dallas County. Dallas thinks it's going to have 40 open points of dispensing with 8,000 to 10,000 people manning those different points of different clinics or points of dispensing, and they don't have the manpower of the 8,000 to 10,000. So they're looking for volunteers as part of the Medical Reserve Corps. This is something I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, the Medical Reserve Corps. This is something the Medical Reserve Corps would do, would be to supplement health departments with volunteers in the case of an anthrax release or other bioterrorism event. So that's open point to dispensing. Then they said, well, we don't have enough manpower really to do this. Most local health departments don't. So they wanted to forge agreements, and the CDC is really pushing the long-term, the local health departments to establish closed points of dispensing, which are what I talked about, businesses, universities, and other large employers, or even churches could be involved and distribute to their membership. And so that takes a lot of the load off of these open points of dispensing by creating closed points of dispensing. So closed points of dispensing are sometimes called private pods, and open pods are sometimes called public pods. So you got the public and the private pods.
Right.
That's something that every health either is working on, has thought about. We did a survey recently, our company did, and it said 89% of the counties out there have been considering doing closed pods. About 75% of them actually have closed pods.
Okay. 75%. So, well, that's not bad, actually.
No, it's not bad, except that they may be, you know, we don't know how many closed pods they have. So they have at least one.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the counties, even if they have a closed pod or multiple closed pods, could use a lot more closed pods.
Right.
But, you know, that all sound, what, in St. Louis County, I think you said there are 1 million people and you have about 700,000 of them covered with these closed pods. That sounds really manageable. But how does that translate
right.
to a city like Los Angeles or New York City where you have populations, you know, into the double-digit millions?
Right. So I've talked to the people in Los Angeles, the health department people there, who are aware of the problem, working the problem. In fact, they're, I understand, starting September, they're going to make a major push on how they deal with the bioterrorism event. And I know they're planning on hundreds, literally hundreds of these open pods. And they feel that's because they're so large. You know, I think the population in L.A. is about 12 million. And that's, I think, just in L.A. County. Do you guys know them? Is that correct or is that off?
George, would you?
Right.
I knew you were going to.
12 to 6, isn't it like it's like somewhere between 12 and 16, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, in the county, the city, yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Let's not quibble over a few million.
Right. A lot more than the St. Louis. Yeah.
Yeah, no question about that. No question. And so they're opening hundreds of these open pods, and they do have a staffing plan for them, and so they feel reasonably confident that they could manage that if they had to. One of the things about LA is it's very sprawling, and anthrax is very targeted. So if it hits the north side of LA, for example, you would expect the south side of LA to be safe.
Right.
If it hits the south side or the east side, if it hits a quadrant of Los Angeles, it's not going to affect all 12 to 16 million people all at once.
Yeah, Harlan.
So I think.
I'm sorry, Harlan. That's one of the things that I think, you know, when we talk about hazards, we really, in some way, we focus on the fear points. What are the fear points? And the spread of bioterrorism, it seems like bioterrorism could affect a lot of people quickly, without their control, their ability to escape, and so forth. But when you're talking about anthrax, it really is very localized. I mean, also, there have been several reports on the national media about Ebola and hemorrhagic fever in Africa and what's happening there. But when you talk about hemorrhagic fever, it's bodily fluids. I mean, if you're not in contact with the bodily fluids of the infected person, you're not going to get it. And so that's something that people feel that they can avoid by staying in their homes or in their cars or lock the doors or whatever. Are there threats out there that people can't run from? Those are the ones that are most scary.
Joe, we all know that anything that Mother Nature throws at us is going to be so much worse than anything that terrorists can come up with. I mean, seriously,
that's probably
right?
True, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, that's the stuff that you can't run from.
So if you look back at now you're talking pandemic. And if you look back at the last really severe pandemic, which is in 1918, it was Spanish flu. Interestingly enough, do you all know why it was called the Spanish flu?
No. Why?
Not because it originated in Spain, because it actually originated in Kansas on a military base. But the reason it was called the Spanish flu was because World War I was going on at that time, and Spain was the only country that didn't have a media blackout.
Hmm.
And so Spain was reporting on it, so it became known as the Spanish flu because they were the only ones really reporting on it. At least that's the story I heard. Because otherwise it makes no sense why it would be called the Spanish flu.
Right.
Because it started in Kansas. So the 1918 pandemic was, and Jackie, you're right, because that killed between 20 and 100 billion, probably the closest estimate is 40 to 50 million. They don't know because in third world countries they didn't really keep records. So we know in the United States it killed over 600,000 people, about 660,000 people. And that started in Kansas and was spread through the military. And that attacked, you know, very healthy, young, but not, you know, not children. It attacked very young, healthy men and women, for the most part, between the ages of 20 and 40. That was a majority of the people that died. It was almost like the healthier your immune system was the more it attacked it.
Hmm.
And so now we don't know whether we'll have another pandemic that bad, but I will say this. I mean, there's no, you know, once a pandemic occurs, there's no vaccine that's readily available. Vaccines still are 4 to 6 months away. We haven't changed our vaccine manufacturing process in 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if a pandemic was very severe, if the 2009 pandemic, for example, had decided to turn very deadly, and that's really up to the virus and how it mutates, there was very little at that time we could have done, even in 2009, to prevent a lot of deaths. I mean, they would occur. Now, we all thought H5N1, the Asian flu, back in 2006 when I started learning about this, we all thought that H5N1 was going to be the next pandemic possibly and a large killer, because it still today kills about 60% of the people that come down with it.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, it's not in the United States, and it's not easily transmissible from human to human. That's the key, is that people get these, but I think, Joe, you pointed out, since with some things it's very hard to for one person to give another.
Mm-hmm.
So with H5N1, this avian influenza, you know, we all called it bird flu in 2006, 2007, when it was getting a lot of media
mm-hmm.
attention. That's very hard to transmit from one person to another, fortunately. It's still being transmitted from chickens and birds to humans.
Right.
And so that's why it hasn't spread a lot. There are some lab studies that have shown that with just a few mutations, it can become highly transmissible from person to person.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been created in the lab setting. Fortunately, that has not been created in the real world. But but who knows if it ever will.
Right.
It could.
And you know, when we talk about Mother Nature, of course, people have talked about in those circles that they talk about this. And then, of course, there's many, many science fiction accounts and movies and books about weaponized viruses, man-made or altered natural viruses. For instance, when the flu season hits, it's incredible how you can have the flu or know someone that has the flu here in California, and then you call someone in New York, and they've got it too. It spreads mm-hmm. incredibly fast. It's incredible across regions, across countries even. The flu, when it does spread, spreads incredibly fast if it's airborne or if it is easily transmittable. And if that were weaponized, then that's one of the great fears of those that are trying to create chaos. But we
and that's a concern of the people that have created this in the laboratory.
Yeah.
Because if the virus from the laboratory ever gets out,
right.
you could have the pandemic that we're talking about.
Right.
So there are precautions. So a lot of people say it's safe. Some people say it's dangerous. A lot of people say it's safe. I don't have enough knowledge independently to be able to judge which side is correct, but hopefully it'll never get out.
Well, we're having a great discussion here, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about the Biodefense Network in St. Louis County and in a larger context, the nature of the hazard, biological terrorism or biological warfare and of course then just the pandemics of natural disasters such as the flu, but when they're especially bad as they can be, they really do travel the world. We'll be talking more with Harlan Dolgin and the Biodefense Network in a moment. I thought we'd go to a break. You're listening to the South Bay Show. We're going to be back in a moment, but we'd also like you to call in. If you're listening live, please do call in at 714-242-5288. That's 714-242-5288. We'd love to have your comment or question. And Jackie, who do we want to thank today?
Well, Joe, you know it's never too early to begin planning your financial future. When it comes to protecting your assets and hard-earned dollars, you'll want experienced professionals with a proven track record and flawless reputation on your team. Briganti, Cameron, Waters & Strong, Certified Public Accountants and Consultants, is the largest full-service accounting firm in the South Bay, and they are dedicated to providing professional services of the highest quality. The partners are South Bay residents deeply committed to serving the communities where they live, work, and play. They support a variety of local nonprofit organizations such as Skate Park PV, Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy, the Torrance South Bay YMCA, Rotary, and Pediatric Therapy Network, among others. BCWS prides itself on providing national accounting technical experience with the personal attention of a local company. This commitment to uphold high standards of excellence has proven key to their success and first-rate reputation. Their ultimate goal and reward is to see their clients achieve financial success as they define it, whether that means helping them to reduce their tax burden, assisting them with planning to ensure their financial security, succession planning, exit strategies, and wealth transfer. The partners and professionals of BCWS are committed to providing their clients with the expertise and guidance they need to reach their financial goals. For more information, visit the website at www.bcws.com or call 310-542-0011.
All righty. So, Harlan, I don't think that many people have a lot of general fear about these kinds of things, in their daily lives. They don't go on thinking about these things. We in the West, in California, we think about earthquakes more often, and that's kind of crazy because we know most people aren't prepared for earthquakes. And if we think about those more often, I guess that shows you how much we think about bioterrorism. But and of course, people in St. Louis think about perhaps floods and severe weather. Where do you think this stands as one of the sort of the all hazards that we face as a country?
Well, I don't think it's something that's imminent. And by the way, in St. Louis, we think about earthquakes too because we have the New Madrid Fault here locally. But I think every region, as you kind of pointed out, every region is a little different in what it considers to be its top threats. And this anthrax is certainly worrisome at the federal level, the CDC. And if you're a state public health official or a local public health official, it is one of the top things that you have to prepare for, because the risk of something happening and us not being prepared, is thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people die. So it's not something for the average person, for the average CERT member, for example, because I know that's a large part of your audience. I would say that this is not something to worry about on a day-to-day basis, certainly. If you want to get involved, you should try and join your local MRC, because one of the things they do, and there are closed pod exercises going on all over the country, where the MRC members are utilized either as patients or as dispensers or some other job actually at the closed pod. And so the MRC is an avenue through which everybody can get involved, generally speaking, and you can ask your MRC coordinator, if they work on closed pods and have exercises, because generally speaking they do. And they would get training, and all of that is free. They'd get training on what to do if there were an anthrax release.
And not only that, they'd be first in line to get the medicine.
Right. That's a good point, because all volunteers and your family, so all volunteers and their families are first in line to get medicine, because they don't want a volunteer being concerned that my family's, out there standing in a long line, not getting their medicine. So, right. So yeah, that's a good point. That's a good benefit.
Sign me up.
It's very hopeful. The way you paint this picture, Harlan, this is a model for the rest of the country, and this is something that could, obviously biohazards or any kind of a hazard where people need medication or people need some kind of, as we call them, they call them prophylactic treatment, this model could provide that.
Yeah, absolutely. And more, we've worked in probably 8 or 9 communities. We have 3 more lined up. In California, we worked in Butte County, which is very northern tip. It's 2 hours above Sacramento, and helped them out with a closed pod program. So, yeah, this is definitely something that a lot of counties are trying to work out themselves. Some have hired us to do this, but others have had some moderate successes with it, so that's good news. So, yeah, it's something that's continuously being worked on.
I'm volunteering George to handle the South Bay pods. Okay, George?
Very good. Are you up for it, George?
Because George knows everybody. He's connected,
right?
I think he's the man for the job. Not necessarily countywide, but I think he should be. Yeah. Him and Jeff Robinson, the Area G. I'm volunteering them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, talk to me in a couple of years when I retire from this and go full-time in disaster management.
Okay.
Aren't we less than 2 years now, George? Like a year and 8 months? Like no one's
counting.
Couple of years. When we think about this, it's very exciting, but also somehow we're talking to the company that has really spearheaded this. Harlan, this is big news actually, and your company bio-defensenetwork.com is really at the center of this whole effort. This is quite
We really are.
Yeah,
which we're very proud of that. We're the only company that focuses and specializes in closed pod recruitment. We can do training and exercises. I mean, we can help planning. So we do all of that, and we were the first ones because of the St. Louis County project. And after that, we realized that we had a real affinity. So to talk about the expectations in St. Louis County when we started the project, we were originally hired to recruit 70,000 people to be part of closed pods.
Mm-hmm.
And they had already had 270,000 people, so we were supposed to get them up to 340,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked them for a stretch goal, and they said, well, if you could get 50% of the population, so 500,000, that would leave us the other 50%. And so we had no idea what we'd be able to do, and within a very short time, this was a five-month project, so it was a very short-term project. And as I said, we got them up to 720,000 people. So it was wildly successful beyond our imaginings, really. And then we realized that we had an affinity for this. So we did start, we went to some national conferences that public health departments go to, mm-hmm. and just shared our story, the success story, and then some of them hired us to carry it forward in their communities. And we've been very successful wherever we've gone. So. We've been in Dallas. We've been in, I said, Butte County. We've been in a couple of small counties in New York.
Mm-hmm. What is really exciting about this, really, is that you've found a model that satisfies so many constraints at once. I mean, the public sector is trying to stretch dollars, and they don't have the manpower. So open pods, although a necessity, cannot reach the general public. Closed pods, on the other hand, you have private dollars coming in, people taking care of their employees or universities taking care of their students. They have an incentive beyond the saving human lives and so forth and being prepared, but they have an incentive to be one of those. If the next university down the block is prepared, then I've got to be prepared so I can tell my incoming students' families and parents that we're prepared like they are down the block. And so you tapped into something that really kind of rolls on its own in terms of encouraging these organizations, private organizations, to be prepared. And I think that's very hopeful for what's going to happen in other places.
Yeah, it really is, and my partner has a great way of saying it. So he could say to an employer, if there's an anthrax release in your community, where do you want your employees to be? Do you want them cowering at home with their families, which a lot of people would be? Do you want them in line in an open pod with 50,000 of their closest friends? Because literally, like for in St. Louis County, they assume 50,000 people will go through each pod, so I assume that's a pretty standard number.
Okay.
Or do you want to say, come to work, we've got your life-saving meditation?
Right.
And so for you and your family. And so it's really a situation where the employers, it's a win for everybody. It's obviously a win for the community because you've got shorter lines at the open pods as you get more closed pods. So you can service more people. It's a win for the public health department because they're able to do to complete the CDC mandate of giving medicine to everybody for 48 hours. It's a win to the employer who's actually able to stay in business longer because they basically are having people come to work. I mean, it wouldn't be exactly business as normal, but they'll get back to business as normal much quicker by being able to control how quickly they give all their people medicine. Mm-hmm. And it's a win for the employee or the people getting the medicine, you know, who take it much faster.
Right.
So it's a win for everybody all around, and there's no cost to it at all because the cost is all prepaid, even the medicine is free.
Right. So can we talk a little bit about that? I mean, the costs. How should we think about that? You say the costs are prepaid. Give us an example, and how does this all work?
So when I say the costs are prepaid, I mean the medicine is already bought by the federal government and is given out free because it's a disaster situation. So what happens? So I think you want me to describe like how a company would get involved in this program.
Well, I assume, Harlan, that you're not working for free.
Well, so I get paid by the county. So I don't get paid by any company. So a county hires us to come in and to help them establish relationships with companies, you know, large employers that would have sufficient, ability to distribute enough. So, for example, in Dallas County, their minimum requirement is 1,000 employees or more, or 4,000. So in the case of a church membership, for example, 4,000 people or more, because they assume that every employee has three dependents at home. That's just an assumption that most counties go with across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means 1,000 employees represents 4,000 courses of medicine that they would give out. And the families don't have to come to the pod. That's one concern that people have, because the employee is allowed to take enough medicine for their families and bring it home. So they just have to fill out a form and be able to answer a few simple questions about whether their family members are allergic to medicines, whatnot, mm-hmm. and then they'll be able to take it home to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's no cost to the businesses.
No cost to the businesses at all for any of this, including my time when I go into a community and recruit businesses. There's no cost to them at all.
Right.
So, for example, in Oswego County, New York, we went in, we were able to gather people together for a meeting. We got 14 of the 16 largest employers in Oswego County. Now it's a small county of a couple hundred thousand people, but we were able to get 14 of the 16 largest employers into a room where we could talk to them about it, and they all responded very positively, as you can imagine, and it was a wonderful program. So that's how we do it. We go in and we try and get multiple businesses in a room to sit down together and talk about it, so everybody can hear everybody else's questions and they hear our responses, and so it really seems to work out well. The other question, the biggest question we get, or the most frequent question we get, is about liability, because you got people that aren't doctors or nurses handing out medicine, and is that legal? It sounds a little fishy, but but actually there's a federal law called the PREP Act, P-R-E-P, and it stands for Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody can look it up. It's called the PREP Act. And that actually prohibits any liability, any lawsuits from people that are participating in this program up and down the chain. So manufacturers, people that have the property, that where it's being given out can't be sued. The people that are the volunteers that are handing out the medicine can't be sued. The companies that are participating in this can't be sued. And the only exception to that, which you would expect, is for willful misconduct. So that means basically somebody does something intentionally to hurt somebody else, then they're not going to, they're not going to cover that under the PREP Act. But everything else, as long as you're doing according to the PREP Act, according to the closed pod protocols, then you're certainly not going to be held liable for anything that happens.
Right, right. Wonderful, wonderful. This is so hopeful. I'd be talking about ways in which health preparedness can be forwarded in the future, but this sounds like something that in a matter of a few years could really be rolled out across the country.
Yeah, it definitely could be.
Wow. This is,
we're actually making that proposal to the CDC right now, so keep your fingers crossed.
Right. This is amazing. This is amazing because it really does involve and get involved the private sector in a way that doesn't cost money. The public sector, in some cases, as you say, the medications are already potentially available, but then the counties certainly have funds available to enact these kinds of programs if there was someone there with a plan, and you guys have the plan already in place. That's a beautiful thing. I'm very excited.
Right. Now the issue is actually the funding at the county level, because as you guys probably are aware, the counties, due to sequestration and other things, the counties just have less and less funds to deal with public health. Their budgets have been going down 3 or 4 years in a row now. So that actually is the biggest roadblock. There are a lot of counties that want to hire us and can't hire us because there's no funding to do it. So that's actually the struggle. But over the last 3 years, even through all of that, and with reduced funding levels, enough counties have wanted to hire us that has kept us in business. So,
right.
So we're hoping that funding actually improves over the next few years.
I imagine it certainly can't get
much worse.
I imagine you're not soliciting Detroit.
Right. No, not right now.
Not right now.
Jackie, be nice.
I'm just saying.
let's just go back real quick. The county of Los Angeles is listed at around $10 million. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure that is including the city of Los Angeles itself, which is around $3,800,000
to $900,000.
Okay.
Wow.
And the figure 12 to 16 million probably includes all the visitors they get every day,
right?
All the hotels, because Los Angeles has a booming hotel business. In fact, you know, that's one of the big concerns, because people that stay at hotels, if there's an anthrax release while somebody's at a hotel, they're not going to know where to go. They're not going to possibly have transportation to get there.
Right.
So hotels is a really that's almost a separate nut to crack. In terms of they're much better off being a closed pod where the medicine comes to the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And Marriott's actually been a leader in that, because they had a pilot project going back in 2009. I believe it was that long ago, for closed pods, where they were studying how to do closed pods appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually going to be issuing a report on that, I think, by the end of this year.
Incredibly hopeful. I mean, you're talking, if we were talking about a hotel, I mean, they wouldn't need much more than, you know, sort of a corner of a closet to have all the medications in place for everyone in the hotel. So it's not a logistics issue. It's not a storage issue. It's really just a forethought issue.
Right. Exactly right. You know, they've got major ballrooms where they can set up, you know, big stations to process people through, lots of
right.
people. So, yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
Would any of these closed pods, for instance, let's say a grocery store or a major department store, would they also be, after they've taken care of their employees, would they be opening to the public as well?
Generally, they would not. So once they're done with their population in the closed pod, we do recommend that their employees who are already trained in this, whoever's volunteered, go to the open pods and help out there.
I see.
But no, generally speaking, and there's a grocery chain in St. Louis that considered becoming an open pod, and you know, they've got a pharmacy, so they could do it out of there. The problem is, if they don't have a good enough security team, it could very quickly turn into a pretty chaotic event.
Right.
And so we kind of discourage them from being an open pod that would be open to the public, because they would just get inundated. And I don't know that they're that they would have the resources to be able to deal with that.
I see. Okay.
So, you know, whereas all the police and fire would be going to these open pods, so there would be lots of security at a normal open pod.
Right.
Joe, we need to get to upcoming events.
Yes, at this time normally, thank you so much, Harlan. Please hold on. George is going to have some announcements of future events and notes. George?
Wow, it's about time. I mean, I realize this is extremely interesting, and, you know, I love this show. I always get to learn more. Just coming up this coming weekend, on Saturday the 19th, our CERT Association is putting on a Red Cross First Aid CPR and AED training class for the community. It is at our in our community room at 420 15th Street in Manhattan Beach. If anybody's interested, email me at info@mbcerta.org. This is open to the general public. This next Tuesday, we are going to have a conversation about community resilience. Something we really haven't spoke about, something that I learned quite a bit about when I took a class from University of New Zealand correspondence, because they in New Zealand they talked a lot about community resilience with their wildfires and their earthquakes. Greg Long from 1033 Disaster Preparedness Consulting will be joining us. And we're going to be talking about what communities do need to do. We're going to be talking about the new normal, because after a disaster, nothing ever really comes back to the old normal. It just doesn't work out that way. So that's coming up next Tuesday on the 22nd in the morning. Continuing in July, on the 25th, 26th, and 27th in Cerritos at the Sheridan, L.A. County's Area E, we'll have a regional, they are hosting the 2014 CERT Community Preparedness Conference there, and it's a three-day event. I've been to them before. It's fabulous. Mm-hmm. That's what we've got going right now, a long way away before we get to the home down fair and our shakeout in October.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that's very good. Looking forward to that. I'm very hopeful, Harlan. What you've painted, the picture that you've painted in this program, is one of a great deal of hope and a very well executed plan that brings together the best of public and private partnerships, both the government getting their mandate satisfied and these private companies protecting their employees, protecting their businesses, really, because the employees are going to feel much safer being involved in the company during a time of crisis. And actually being at work during a time of crisis.
You know, Joe, have you noticed lately in the last year or so on our shows that has become a recurring theme, is the taking care of the employees? You know, when we started out, it was all about preparedness. And when people think of preparedness, they think about, do I have enough water? Do I have enough extra medication? Do I have shelter? Do I know first aid? But in the last year, a lot of the people we've spoken with it's been about taking care of the employees, because let's face facts, companies are in the business to make money, and you can't make money without employees.
Right.
And it sounds like a lot more companies, a lot more of the corporate world really are getting that now. It's not just a matter of having flashlights and waters and blankets, you know, in the schools or, mm-hmm. In the hospital. You've not only got to take care of your employees, you got to take care of your employees' families, because if the families aren't well, the employees aren't going to be there.
Right. Well, what that reminds me of, Jackie, is that for the longest time, in the early days of collective bargaining and workers' rights and so forth, It's unions, and not so much unions I'm thinking of, but the organization of private companies that provided a support network, a security blanket, or really a fallback mechanism for people, whether it be public health, whether it be injury on the work in the workplace, and so forth. The government didn't do it; private employers did, and maybe that's the way forward for all. You know, an all-hazards approach is going to involve employers eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we all know things run much more smoothly when the government doesn't get involved.
Right?
You were going there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, seriously. You know, the private sector is much more efficient than the government.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
And having worked in the private sector, I can tell you that that's definitely true. A lot of people think that it just started around 9/11, but it's actually been going on since the 70s, where companies realize they need to protect their employees. They need to protect all their assets, and part of their asset base is their employees,
right?
Also their computer systems and others. So yeah, my full-time job for most of the last 15 years when I wasn't being a consultant was being a business continuity manager for one company or another. Helping them make sure that they are prepared for basically any contingency.
Right. This is, I agree with you, Jackie, 100%. I think that in some way, you know, as we've gone on for the last couple of years talking to different organizations about public readiness in general and preparedness, the solutions all seem to have the same kind of shape. And they involve public-private partnerships with private companies and organizations taking the lead. And this is the way it works here in America. It's really wonderful to see.
Yeah. Well, that's what CERT is all about, right?
Right.
Right, George?
You betcha.
Right.
Is the public, the private sector and private citizens, you know, doing their part?
Well, that's a great segue to how CERT, Community Emergency Response Team, works. We saw in the CERT class that I was able to take a part of just a month or two ago, the private support that we got from several companies there to show us the kinds of materials that we need to protect ourselves. And I'm thinking of course, moreprepared.com. And then, of course, the chief was there, and we've gotten a tremendous amount of support from the public sector, from the fire department. And you put those two together, and the city is better prepared. And I think that's really what we want to see happen all across the country, is that more private companies and the public sector get together to prepare the public. When something happens, everyone is going to be, they're going to know what to do and feel more in control. And that's all you really can do. I mean, it's a situation that's literally, technically, it's an emergency and it's also a surprise. And it's, you know, how can you plan for everything? You can't. But
you can't.
No.
You can't. But we're doing the best we can.
Right.
let's get some contact information from Harlan.
Yes, Harlan, tell us how to get in touch with the BioDefense Network.
Yeah, I'll give you my email and my phone number. My email is hdolgin, so that's hdolgin, at bio-defensenetwork.com. And you can also reach me at 314-304-4354.
And can you give us that information again, the email and the phone number?
Sure, hdolgin at bio-defensenetwork.com. And my phone number is 314-304-4354.
I don't know the last time, Harlan, that we've had such a hopeful program with such a clear path,
right?
towards a solution. This is pretty special.
Wait. Okay, but that the clear path is only going to work if we get the local counties, the governments,
right,
to actually take part in this. And we all know that funding is our biggest obstacle in any case, whether it be local or county or state, and then into federal. So it's, yes, it is, you know, it's the opportunity is there. Hopefully everybody will jump on board and make it work.
Well, I hope so too. Thank you, George.
Thank you.
Thank you, Harlan, for joining us today.
Thank you for letting me share.
And thank you, Jackie.
Always a pleasure, Joe.
What a great show. Thank you for joining us today, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you on Thursday for the Spotlight in the South Bay. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.